This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, in part two of our look at youth in America, we turn to a startling and disturbing trend. The arrest rate for girls between the ages of 10 and 17 is growing fast, up 40% over the past 20 years, and more are being charged with violent crimes, which in turn creates another problem. After girls are arrested and convicted, there is often no place to put them, and little in the way of counseling, drug treatment, or mental health care. Many juvenile facilities and resources are designed for boys. This hour, what happens to girls in a juvenile justice system that is not prepared for them? Later in the program, we'll follow up on a report that Attorney General John Ashcroft has asked federal prosecutors to identify judges who hand down lenient sentences and then file appeals for longer terms. But first, why so many more girls are coming into the juvenile justice system and what's happening to them once they get there. If you know girls who've been through the system or work with them, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. Joining us now is Mita Chesney Lind. She's a professor of women's studies at the University of Hawaii who has studied girls and aggressive behavior. She joins us from Hawaii Public Radio in Honolulu. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Aloha, Neil. I'm glad to be here.
Aloha. What does this rise indicate? Why are so many more girls coming into juvenile justice system?
Well, as your setup made very clear, we opened this new millennium with images that were just sort of flying at us of sort of girls gone wild. And I think if we step back from this, we think about the last decade, and you remember this boy super predator that we were so scared of. Mm-hmm. And now what we've gotten is the latest bad, you know, latest flavor of bad girl moral panic. But as you also noted, it's meant huge run-ups in the number of arrests of girls for offenses that we used to always associate with boys.
Are they being arrested for our moral outrage?
In part, I think, you know, in the 70s, we were really concerned with who girls went to bed with. And we arrested girls for running away from home and, you know, getting in our face and dating boys we didn't like. And by the, you know, the turn of the century, we'd really sort of shifted our moral, you know, the boundaries of the moral world that we patrol to sort of minor kinds of youth violence. And that includes, you know, girl-on-girl violence. It includes parents who want to get their daughters arrested for, you know, being defiant, but they can't get them arrested anymore for running away. So we arrest them for domestic violence, essentially. And in a lot of jurisdictions, that means it's a girl or a woman who's being hauled off, you know, because she's being violent, as opposed to what we would imagine, which would be the, you know, the male perpetrator.
Well, girls can be perpetrators, too.
Correct. Yeah, as we saw in the Glenbrook High instance. And I think that's the other hidden piece of this, is that girls have always been aggressive. And we know this from looking at self-report data, that girls reported in the 60s and 70s that they were fighting with other girls often, or with, you know, basically family members. But we didn't arrest them for those things then. We just weren't paying attention to that. And we were, you know, as I say, our focus has really kind of shifted. But here's the punchline. The self-report data on fighting has been going down in the last decade, not up. So that's the real puzzle, is if, you know, if we were really seeing a change in behavior, the kids would be reporting it.
So
as the data we've got.
Is what you're saying, though, that as police take domestic violence cases more seriously, that they are arresting because of girls tend to, as that self-reporting data seems to indicate, mm-hmm. They have a lot of fights with family members.
Well, it's if you think throwing a plate of cookies at your mom is an assault, you know, then, yeah, that's what's going on. But I think it's, again, I know you love complex on this program, so but it's like we've got families or perpetrators who are a little more savvy about domestic violence laws than they were in the past. And as a result of that, you see these huge run-ups in the numbers of girls. Well, just take California. The number of women and girls arrested for domestic violence in California tripled in the last decade. So I think it's more than just, you know, we're paying attention to domestic violence. It's that sometimes perpetrators or, in this case, maybe child abusers are getting smart about, you know, let's just say to the daughter, you know, my daughter slapped me, and then I know the police will arrest her. and put her where I want her put, which is, you know, a detention center. So we've had instances, I've talked to public defenders who talk about, you know, parents essentially getting information from police about what to say when, you know, the responding officer comes. That's the problem. It's like bootstrapping, taking what is essentially a status offense that we used to bust in the 70s and relabeling it as, and that's why lethal violence has been going down, not up.
One other factor, though, is schools, where have zero tolerance for any kinds of violations at all. And again, if as the self-reporting indicates, girls have some confrontations with their classmates,
correct,
that's going to be prosecuted as well.
And I think that's another huge sort of hidden factor in what's happened to kids' arrests. And when you patrol very minor forms of violence, you know, go back in my own past, not that I did hit people. Actually, I always tell reporters, I hit my sister. Margaret, I'm sorry. I know you're listening. you know, I always talk to reporters and I say, well, did you hit your sister when you were growing up? And, you know, if the answer is yes, you perpetrated assaults on family members. And so, and the same is true of that school, the girl fight at Park Rose High School way back when, mm-hmm, that we all heard about and, whoa, it's going to be after school. That's now, you know, zero tolerance. We're not only going to arrest the perpetrators, but we're also going to arrest, you know, there's sometimes just people standing around watching it.
Well, let's
and that happened in Glenbrook, too, actually.
Yeah, the famous videotape.
Let's
talk now to somebody whose experience is on the ground. Gary Lacey is county prosecutor for Lancaster County, Nebraska, which includes the city of Lincoln, and he joins us from his office in Lincoln, Nebraska. Good of you to be with us.
Well, thank you very much.
Are you seeing a rise in the number of girls going through the being arrested in your county?
Yeah, I think the figures probably are 60-40 on juvenile court filings, where it probably wasn't that great 10-15 years ago. 60% boys, 40% girls.
And that's high. That's a lot more girls than used to be, as you said.
Oh yeah.
Are girls, do you think, being treated more harshly?
No, I think it's probably a combination of things, but I guess what I see most is there's a general lowering of the standards of supervision of parents. That is, they're letting girls do things that in the past they would only let boys do. They let their daughters go, have more freedom to go to shopping malls, to go driving around with their friends, to go to other people's houses where there may or may not be supervision. And that gives the girls an opportunity to act like boys.
What about the statistics that Amita Chesney-Lind was telling us about, that most of the assaults that are being charged are involved either in domestic violence or at school?
Well, domestic violence is a bad situation. I mean, I'm very upset by a man and a woman who are married or not having fist fights in front of children, and that's happening all the time. And I think they kind of learn, some of them in some families, they learn that as a mechanism for settling disputes. But I can't say that I can agree or disagree with the fact that there's more domestic disputes.
Mm-hmm.
I know there are moms and dads who are frustrated that they can't access mental health facilities and other sorts of facilities when they have a child that's acting out, and they've become ungovernable, or they just can't deal with them, and they would like someone to take charge, and sometimes that's hard to do.
There may not be more domestic disputes, but are more girls being arrested as police view domestic disputes differently?
Well, in the Midwest, especially here in the capital city of Lincoln, I don't think we have a whole lot of actual assaults by young women. What we see more of is more trespassing, more thefts, more bad check writing, credit card abuse. You know, they're out there where the boys are, and they're doing the same things that boys do.
We were talking earlier about how in the past these crimes were overlooked, that police didn't necessarily intervene as often in domestic disputes, as schools did not have zero tolerance. Are girls being treated unfairly now?
Well, no, I don't think. I think they're being treated. It's probably a product of them being treated more equally, and they're getting the same sorts of privileges as their male siblings were in the past. They're coming up to that point, and I see a general lack of supervision among parents of their children. I don't know whether they think they can just, you know, turn them loose in a shopping mall and think that the security police there are going to govern their behavior, but they just don't get it sometimes about their responsibility for ensuring that there's proper supervision of these, you know, 10, 12, 13, 14-year-olds.
Mita Chesney-Lind, I was wondering if you'd get
yes.
a response.
Well, I really liked a point that he made about kids who are violent often grew up in homes that that were violent. When we look at the histories of girls who are having problems with aggression, and particularly physical aggression, we could talk about relational aggression in a second if you want to, but girls who are physically aggressive show a very distinct pattern of having grown up in violent families, and they're mimicking the violence that they see often from an abusive father, but definitely an abusive family, and they see that as a kind of way to access that power. But unfortunately, they turn that that violence on not the people who are hurting them, whether it's abusive boyfriends or family members. They turn it on other girls, and so some of us call that horizontal violence. When you're basically frustrated and feel sort of powerless, and so the girls will say that I hate her because she's just like me, and the girls, so there's this sort of, that's a very important part of the dynamic when you work with kids who have violence, with problems with violence. For boys, the source of the violence is growing up in a violent neighborhood, not necessarily a violent home. So that's why when we say, when you do violence prevention in the schools, you really need to talk to girls about whole different sets of things. You've got to talk about dating violence, family violence. With boys, you need to talk more about bullying. So this is where we come into the why we need to be having this conversation and why we need to talk about, because the one other thing that's happened, and I think Mr. Lacey made this point very well, I was startled at his 40% figure, but definitely referrals of girls to juvenile courts are way up, while referrals of boys are not up by nearly as much. 76% increase in referrals in the last decade of girls. So the girls are gushing into this system, and you said it well. This is Fonzie that we were trying to control. It's we don't have any programs for these girls, and social workers and probation officers and judges are just really getting kind of frantic, because what happens when these girls come in with relatively minor offense backgrounds is they have major problems.
Well, we're going to talk about more about that later in the program. Let's see if we can get a quick call from Suzanne in Overland Park, Kansas.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I want you to look at a different aspect of violence. We have four children, a girl that we adopted when she was 2.5 weeks old, has had multiple problems. Her mother did drugs, alcohol, tobacco, attempted suicide while she was pregnant with this girl. We've had psychiatric intervention from the very beginning, and approximately 2.5 years ago, she started becoming psychotic. We had to hospitalize her several times, and the insurance ran out, wouldn't take care of her. We went through tried to make her a child in need of care. The judge said that's not the way to go. If she is violent towards you, any of you in the family, call the police. Yep. She attacked my husband, and then the next day she attacked me. And she was, after that hospitalization, I brought charges, and she was set into the juvenile system.
Yeah. Suzanne, I'm going to have to ask you to stay on hold for just a minute. We have to take a short break, but we'll finish up on this call when we get back, okay?
Thank you.
All right, you just stay on hold, and Mita, if you could stay with us, and Gary Lacey, can you stay with us as well?
Sure.
Okay, we're going to take a short break and continue with this phone call when we come back. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about girls in the juvenile justice system. While more girls are being incarcerated, many face a system that is not prepared for them. If you'd like to join our conversation, our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. Our guests are Mita Chesney-Lind at the University of Hawaii and Gary Lacey, the county prosecutor for Lancaster County in Nebraska. Just before the break, Suzanne was on the line with us from Overland Park, Kansas, talking about a situation. And Suzanne, it's a terrible situation that you describe with your daughter attacking.
The terrible thing has been the whole 2.5 years that she's been in the system, and that there isn't any help, and that what we end up doing is criminalizing mental health, psychiatric patients. And my request is that your guests start looking at how many of these girls were adopted, how many were compromised intrauterinely by the stress level of their parents, the mother, or the use of illegal drugs, especially that we're bringing in more and more babies and people are adopting them from all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Gary Lacey, I know you can't talk about Suzanne's case at all, but is this something that you recognize?
Well, I think in the Midwest, in Kansas and Nebraska and other places in the Midwest, the state is very ill-equipped to handle long-term or even medium or short-term care for young men and women that are described in the situation that the caller is talking about.
Are there mental health facilities that are available, or is the criminal justice system? I realize these go back and forth.
In Nebraska, there really are no really good institutions that you could send someone to. The problem then becomes, while there, Lincoln has a number of nonprofit facilities where they can receive outpatient treatment. But the problem is, how do you integrate them back into their family and still maintain the outpatient treatment?
Amita Chesney-Lind, get a comment from you before we let you go.
She really, first, Suzanne, hang in there. I talked to a lot of parents like you. You're absolutely right that we don't have mental health services, and particularly mental health services for girls who come in with multiple problems. We had a case exactly like that in Hawaii, and actually the family brought suit against our Department of Education to try and get more mental health services for kids in the community. So comorbidity is a huge issue for girls, which means you've got mental health problems plus legal problems, and often these girls are just dumped into detention centers where there's no services for them. So I know your situation well, and it's tragic what's happened to your family.
Suzanne, thanks very much. I know that call wasn't easy.
Thank you so much for listening to me, and I just hope to get out the word that there is a lot of psychiatric problems, a lot, just like you said,
comorbidity.
Comorbidity, and that we've got to be starting to address this. Thank you.
Bye-bye. And Mita Chesney-Lind, we appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is great.
Mita Chesney-Lind is a professor of women's studies program at the University of Hawaii, and she was with us from the studios of Hawaii Public Radio, where most of us wish we were. Also, Gary Lacey, we appreciate your time today.
Not a problem.
Gary Lacey is the county prosecutor for Lancaster County, Nebraska, which includes the capital city of that state, Lincoln. Joining us now is Francine Sherman. She's a law professor and director of the Juvenile Rights Advocacy Project at Boston College's Law School, and she's nice enough to interrupt her vacation in Boulder, Colorado, to speak with us. So good of you to join us on Talk of the Nation.
Oh, my pleasure.
And as you heard the description that we were just talking about, this is something that exists nationwide, is it not?
Yes, it is. I thought Suzanne's call was incredibly helpful. I wanted to make the point that there is a tremendous amount of mental health issues among girls who are currently in the justice system. And what we end up seeing is, the justice system really becomes sort of the system of last resort. When everything else has failed, that's where these girls are ending up.
Do most states have facilities for girls? We just heard that Lincoln certainly does not have mental health facilities.
Well, there are juvenile justice facilities. There are detention centers and your standard juvenile justice programs. But what we see is that, number one, these programs aren't designed to meet the need, the sheer numbers, and more importantly, they're not responding to the specific needs, the mental health needs, the trauma histories these girls present with, the physical health issues they have. They simply are not responding to those kinds of issues, and so they're not providing what we call gender-responsive services.
Did the trend, this sudden, surprising uptick in the number of girls who are being arrested and convicted, did this take states by surprise?
You know, I guess it did. But since 1992, the federal government, through the Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention Act, has been saying to the states that they need to have plans for providing gender-specific services and that they need to assess their services for girls. And so states really have been looking at this. I think the pace of the increase of girls has really, however, taken, you know, a stress system all over and stressed it even more.
What kind of problems has it caused?
Well, you see overcrowding in girls' programs routinely, poor physical space to begin with, and then it becomes even worse and inadequate. And what ends up happening is, you know, you have Suzanne's story is really common. You have many girls. In one study in Cook County, 75% of girls in detention met criteria for one or more psychiatric disorder. That's 75% particular problems with depression and anxiety disorders. And you put those girls in an overcrowded facility where they really end up being put in their rooms as a way of managing the behavior because there are simply too many of them, and that only makes their problems worse.
This is not to say, and we've mentioned that most juvenile facilities were designed for boys, but it's not to say that their systems are great either.
No, and that is really an important point to make, you know, that the juvenile justice system has a lot of problems across the board. The interest in girls now and the concern about girls is because the numbers are really staggering, and they are really... systems are just not knowing how to respond, and people are beginning to recognize that the girls are presenting problems at a scale they're not seeing in the boys. And because so many of them are these minor offenders, so what you get is a population of girls who are very high need but low risk to society.
Let's take another caller. Michelle joins us from Charleston, South Carolina.
Thank you.
Sure.
I was struck as I was listening to your first two guests by the subtext of previous injury to these girls, and your current guest has come close to talking about it, and I'd like to hear her talk about it a little more at length. But I have an opportunity to work with survivors of sexual assault and sexual molestation, and a huge percentage of these girls are very young in age, ranging as low as 9, 8, 6, into their mid-teens. These are assaults that are usually committed within the families, fathers, stepfathers, grandfathers, uncles, cousins, brothers, stepbrothers. And you can see at this initial level how much damage, psychological, emotional damage is being done to the girls. And I'm not just talking about feelings. I mean actual trauma damage to the developing brain and the developing identity of these young girls. And then, you know, working with people further on in the system, as your previous guest mentioned, when they arrive in the criminal justice system, they arrive with this history. My thought is that this entire system, particularly our political decision makers and our society in general, just recoils in horror from the scope and the repetitiveness of sexual violence directed against young girls. I do not want to discount it directed against boys, mm-hmm. But that may be even further repugnant to people. But it is so overwhelming that I think that people are just frankly refusing to see it and therefore refusing to deal with its results.
Well, Francine Sherman, how much of an underlying factor is this?
It's enormous. The caller is absolutely correct. You know, approximately 70% of girls in the justice system, by some studies, have been victims of sexual, physical, or emotional abuse. The level of sexual abuse in the histories of these girls is really staggering at very young ages, at home. And then, you know, this continues and becomes sort of a way of life. Many girls who are in the justice system for a variety of kinds of street crimes are prostitutes. They're teenage prostitutes. And they certainly, those are victims, you know, of the first order. They have continued to be sexually victimized in prostitution. So that's absolutely true. And what's really important here is that, you know, the juvenile justice system, it's a rehabilitative system, but the focus is really on the offense or the crime that the youth has committed. And that's just simply not appropriate in many of these cases.
Well, if this is so well known, does the system have programs or policies to deal with it?
No.
You know, there are some, but no, not at the level it ought to have. You know, anyone who has studied this, you know, the level of trauma that these girls are dealing with, these are lifelong issues. They need a sense of security and safety, and what often happens is they're removed from those kind of community ties and family ties and relationships that are most likely to give them a sense of security and safety. And that's what happens in the justice system. You know, you're pulled away into detention. You're locked up. And, you know, that really contributes to the feeling of being traumatized.
Michelle, thanks for the call. Good point. I guess Michelle has left us. But we thank her for her call. Joining us now is Diane Giddings, formerly at the Adrian Training School for Girls in Adrian, Michigan, one of the toughest facilities for juvenile girls in Michigan. She now volunteers there as a big sister and also helps evaluate programs as a youth member on the board for the Coalition for Juvenile Justice. She's also a mother of three children, and she joins us now from her home in Hudson, Michigan. Thanks for taking time out today.
Hello.
What happened to you? What got you into a girls' facility?
I believe it probably similar to the caller before. A lot of it goes back to trauma as early on. I was also in what's called multi-system, which means before I went into the juvenile system, I was in the foster care system for 6 years, and so for neglect and abuse. And I think that it was a way to try and escape and express my anger.
Mm-hmm. And what did you do to do that?
Running away from home, getting suspended from school for fights, things like that.
And how long did you end up in juvie?
I was in the juvenile detention center for about 6 months before going to the Adrian Training School, where I was for 11 months, which is actually considered really good. Usually girls are there a lot longer.
What was it like?
It was stressful. It was hard. A lot of the girls there were there for a lot more serious crimes than me, and that was difficult.
Did you learn anything?
I think I made a turning point in there. Why I was there, I was pregnant at 15, and I made a turning point. I personally believe it was due to the fact that I was about to have a child and wanted to make great decisions for her. And did not want her to go through the system. So I would say I did take some things maybe, but a lot of the things for me was negative. I mean, I was locked up with sexual offenders,
mm-hmm.
and that was hard, having my daughter come up to visit me with girl sexual offenders there, and I was there with murderers, and I mean, I learned a lot of negative things too.
Was there a moment? You say there was a turning point. Was there, you know, some transformation?
There was a transformation for me, and like I said, it was really okay. You know, you don't want to end up putting your daughter through what you've been through, and I think some people may not make that decision, but that was enough to say, I'm done, and so that was my turning point.
We're speaking with Diane Giddings, formerly at the Adrian Training School for Girls in Adrian, Michigan, and with Francine Sherman, director of the Juvenile Rights Advocacy Project at Boston College's Law School. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Diane, you now act as a big sister, as a volunteer counseling other girls. Has things at Adrian improved?
I don't think that they were really bad. I mean, personally, I believe the system that they have there could maybe use, like, some changes, but that's my opinion. I think maybe what they need there, and I wish people would consider, is employing people who have been in the system. Otherwise, when you're there, and I know this from experience, you kind of look at them like they don't really understand. And so it's hard to open up to people you don't believe understand.
Let's get a call from Allison, who joins us from Grants Pass, Oregon.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. This is a very interesting show. It inspired me to write some thoughts down, and thank you for sharing. I think what your guest said earlier, that the scope of the problem is huge, when I worked as a volunteer at the Oregon Youth Authority, met some of the girls there, and they were saying earlier in the conversation, your two guests, were that, you know, girls get hit with too many images of bad violence. And I thought, you know, that's true. But I think other factors are also affect this trend. They have no fathers, often. They have maybe no mothers or overworked single moms. They have no spiritual home, whether that be a synagogue or a church or a Buddhist temple. These girls don't get fed any kind of spiritual values. Schools can't do it all. Kids want to be good. I believe that kids want to be good, even excellent and famous. And but I feel like our society and our government send them conflicting messages. And I think Hollywood could address this more assertively than they have, and that we as a people accept. Meaning, like the lawyer, the county prosecutor that's on there, he said that girls have more freedom nowadays, and that's why they're able to do more of the bad things that boys used to only do.
Yeah.
But I believe that they can handle freedom if they're in a loving community and family.
Well, let's get a response from Diane Giddings, and particularly on your point, Allison, about spirituality. Were there church religious opportunities when you were in the training center?
Actually, that's why I was going to the OIA, because my church...
Excuse me, Allison, we were trying to get a response from Diane.
Okay,
hello?
Yes, go ahead, Diane.
Yes, there was church actually in the training school.
Okay.
And did girls take advantage of it?
Yes, nobody was forced, but I'd say probably 98% of people did go.
Okay, and one thing I wanted to check with Francine Sherman,
yes.
And that's the number of young girls, who, as Allison was saying, in her experience, are they, lack one parent or are both parents? Is that common?
Yeah, that is common, and it's also the pattern of incarceration through the generations is also common. Absence of a father, incarceration of a father, that's also very common. But, you know, one point that I think it's worth mentioning that draws sort of both of these calls together is that, you know, much of what Diane needed and responded to probably could have been provided to her in a different kind of setting, not in a locked setting, not in a training school with girls who were there for more serious offenses. You know, the pattern of being in a foster home, having a childhood abuse, running away, having school problems and problems adjusting, and then ending up in the delinquency system is really common. And, you know, communities really are the right place to provide these kinds of the spiritual services, the other kinds of services that will really sort of shore up these girls' lives, not training schools.
Diane Giddings, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Diane Giddings, formerly at the Adrian Training School for Girls in Adrian, Michigan, now volunteers there as a big sister. And we'd also like to thank Francine Sherman, director of the Juvenile Rights Advocacy Project at Boston College's Law School. Have a good vacation to Colorado.
Thank you very much.
Also, thanks to Allison for that last phone call. More on this subject after a break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Tomorrow, there are close to 6,000 distinct languages spoken around the world today, and writer Mark Abley says most of them are doomed, a travelogue of endangered languages tomorrow at this time on Talk of the Nation. Today, we're discussing the rise in the number of girls in the juvenile justice system and what happens to them once they're there. If you know any girls who've been through the system, join the conversation. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is totn@npr.org. While there is still a great deal that needs to be done in many facilities around the country, some are trying to do it right. Alan Jensen joins us now. He's the administrator of the Youth Rehabilitation and Treatment Center for Girls in Geneva, Nebraska. They've been trying to incorporate some of the new thinking about sex and girl-specific programs, and he joins us now from his office in Geneva, Nebraska. And good of you to be with us on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for inviting me.
So describe your facility for us.
We're a juvenile correctional facility for adolescent girls 12 to 19 who are sent to us by the various courts in Nebraska.
And how many girls is your capacity?
Our average daily count is 95.
And what was it like before? How new is this facility?
The facility actually itself is quite old. We were built back in 1892. However, since that time, there's been many changes and many new buildings on campus, and many of the old buildings have been tore down.
As I understand it, your facility is 35% minority girls, 66% white.
That's correct.
Many of those are seeing a faster growth, though, in the percentage amongst minorities.
Yes.
Do you think minority or racial differences need to be considered as well?
Yes, I do.
What's the recidivism rate for girls?
Our recidivism rate for our facility is about 12%.
12% who leave come back into the system as juveniles or into the adult system?
Back to our system as juveniles.
Mm-hmm. What kinds of programs do you offer for girls who are in your facility?
We really offer a variety of programs to meet specifically the girls' needs. So often programs across the country, girls' programs across the country, have been designed after boys' programs. And so we feel it's very important that we meet the girls' needs, their very unique needs that they have. Some of your previous callers have talked about the abuse that girls suffer.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in our facility, we see upwards of 70, 80% of our girls who come to us who have been traumatized by sexual abuse, physical abuse, and what have you. So one of the programs we offer here is something called a survivors group program for all of our girls because so many are involved in that. And this gets at issues such as sexual abuse, physical abuse, domestic violence, and so forth.
What about mental health?
Mental health is a growing problem for our system, as it is across the country. 35% of our girls here at our facility have a diagnosed mental health disorders. And we're talking about bipolar disorders, ADHD, manic depressive disorders, and what have you. They have been sent to us for treatment and for rehabilitation in a juvenile justice programs. It's forced us to move our thinking and how to work with these kids who come to us with these disorders.
And substance abuse is obviously a major problem, not only a reason some of the girls are there, but a contributing factor that complicates all the others, doesn't it?
Absolutely. We have a unit on campus designated as a unit that works just with those girls who are considered high-risk drug and alcohol abusers.
Let's get a phone call, and Mike joins us on the line from Denver, Colorado.
Hello.
Hello.
I work for the state of Colorado, and I just wanted to offer the information that Colorado has just recently, in the last little over a year, opened a new facility for juvenile girl offenders, juvenile females, and I believe it's one of the first in the country, if not the first, that was specifically designed, built, and staffed for treatment of female juvenile offenders.
Is it open now?
It is.
And does it have the kinds of programs that Alan Jensen is describing?
Many of them, yes. It's a 40-bed facility. There are a lot of things that you could do with a larger, you know, the more beds, the more opportunities. But, yeah, there are a lot of advocates and proponents for care of juvenile girls were involved in the design of both the building and the programs.
Mike, let me ask you, and Alan Jenkins, Jensen, let me ask you the same question. Given what the facility that you've got there now, can you imagine how inadequate it was before?
Well, yes. I've been involved in the system for quite some time, and girls were always a very difficult, and still are. I mean, the numbers in Colorado are greater than this facility cares for, but girls have always been a real growing problem in our system, just in terms of treatment and adequate placement.
Alan Jensen, same question.
I don't agree with the caller from Colorado. 10 years ago, 15 years ago, our programs weren't meeting the needs of girls. Quite frankly, they were designed after boys' programs. They weren't sufficient in quality and in quantity to meet their unique needs. Today, our programs are designed, whether it be dealing with their medical issues, their behavioral issues, just relationships in general. They've been designed to be very gender responsive to girls and their needs.
Society is... thank you, by the way, Mike, for the phone call. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Before you... Mike, are you still there? I was going to ask him where the facility was. I don't know. Too late. Let me ask you, Alan Jensen. Society is incarcerating girls because they think it is a solution. Do you think it is?
It's part of the answer. It's not the entire answer. I think with many girls in the system, community-based programs can meet their needs. Given that there's good community-based programs, there's sufficient funding to support those programs, and the staffing that is necessary for girls' programs. I think with girls, the staff ratios must be very high. in order to meet their unique needs. And quite often you see in programs overcrowding, poor staff ratios, and poor resources to support those programs. It's an investment, but you invest now or you invest later in the adult system.
Alan Jensen, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Alan Jensen, administrator for the Youth Rehabilitation and Treatment Center for Girls in Geneva, Nebraska, and he joined us from his office in Geneva.